Okay, so we're going to have two question and answers sessions today. This morning's session is in English, and this afternoon's session is in Thai. In this English session, if you are not comfortable in asking a question in English, you can ask in Thai, but I will reply in English. Okay. So if anybody just wants to put up their hand and ask a question, then you can do that as well. But if you prefer to write your question down, then there is paper and pens available. There are. Okay, so this is this question is both languages, and the question is, how valid does this statement hold? Kon mai ru yo mai pit. Okay. Okay, let's have a vote on this first. What do we think? Kon mai ru yo mai pit. Who agrees with that statement? Okay, the question is, if you don't know that something's, if you don't know what something is or what you're doing, then you can't be wrong, or you can't be guilty, or you can't be held responsible. You agree? Okay. Anybody else agree? Okay, well, I'll give my opinion, and then we'll see what everyone else thinks. There is a saying in English, which you may be familiar with, which is, ignorance is bliss. Sometimes you can maintain a sense of well-being by closing your eyes or not finding out the truth about something, just preferring to keep in the dark because you don't want to know the answer. But in the area of ethics or morality or questions of right and wrong, then we have to start right at the very beginning and make sure that we all have the same understanding of what those words mean, because this is often a cause of confusion, very often with the most common words that we all know very well, like good and bad and right and wrong and all these words. And we can easily assume that we're all using those words in the same way, but often we're not, and we can have a lot of unnecessary arguments because of that. So in Buddhism, we have like the ultimate goal of Nibbana. And Nibbana or Nippan means a complete freedom from all suffering and all the causes of suffering. And one who has reached that state of Nippan, and that can be someone who's still alive, is someone whose actions are motivated by wisdom and compassion and inner peace. So we take the highest goal as our base for making decisions about what is good and bad and right and wrong. So most simply we say, anything which takes us even a step closer to Nibbana is good, and anything that takes us even a step away from it is bad. It doesn't have to be really awful or evil, but it means you're moving away from the goal. So any action which results from an intention affected by greed and hatred and delusion, is we call akusan or akusala or unwholesome. And because if you have an unwholesome intention and you act upon it, then you make, by acting upon it, you make it stronger. You make it more likely that it will occur again. You strengthen it. So this is what we call bad karma. Bad karma means when you you have an intention which is affected by, which includes greed, hatred, delusion, or kilesa or gilet, you act upon it. Whereas if you have an intention which is arises from kindness, compassion, integrity, and all these wholesome qualities, then we can call that good karma or just goodness. So how you understand the meaning of an action does obviously have an effect. For instance, if you think that, say, fishing, it's just a sport, you know, it's just good fun, and you don't mean to hurt the fish, or maybe you even think that fish don't feel pain or something like this, but it's just a good day out to go and catch some fish, then you could say, you don't know the truth. The truth is that you are acting with the intention to kill, the intention to harm. Even if you don't have the intention to be cruel, you still have the intention to kill. And that intention is meaningful because it is karma. Okay. So that whether or not you believe that this is ethically significant or meaningful does not mean that you don't receive the karma. And we could look at other religions in which some religions, as you know, teach that if you kill somebody for your religion, then it's a good thing, or to protect your religion, or to persuade other people to change their religion. In other words, if you act violently, cruelly, you kill, but it's not for you personally, it's for your religion, then it's not a bad thing, it's a good thing. So, as Buddhists, we would say that's misguided. And in the technical term in Buddhism for this is micchatitti. And the Buddha said that micchatitti is the most frightening or the most dangerous thing of all. Because if you think that something bad is good, then you have no restraint. Why would you stop? You just do it as much as you can because you think it's good. So, in the case that you've never been exposed to, you never had opportunity to understand the truth. You say you're living in a very strict religious community which forbids you from ever reading any wisdom from any other tradition or any other religion, and you're like brainwashed from child, then the karma that you create would be a lot less, in that you've had very, very little choice in the matter. But nevertheless, if you rejoice and you really enjoy doing this thing, even though it's been taught to you since you're a child, then You still have to take responsibility for that. So in certain cases also, and I think this holds true in the law, there are certain cases where it's your responsibility to find out. You know, you can't say, I didn't know. Well, you should know. And that's, you know, you can't just take that as an excuse. So my summary is that I don't agree with this this idea that not knowing prevents you from doing something wrong or from creating bad karma. Does anyone else have anything to add to that? Any objection to this phrase that I didn't mention? You speak up. Okay. This is another dual language question. Grab namatsagantanajan. What is suksam yanglon? So that's for those of you who don't know the chanting very well, that's a line in the dedication of merit chant, the Imina Bunya chant, which we chanted last night. So suksam yang, the Buddha talked about three kinds of happiness that we can experience or that we should aspire to. And the first kind of happiness is just like everyday happiness that everyone wants to have economic security, to have a good job, to have status, to have a family and loved ones and success in the world, or to the normal kinds of happiness that people generally would wish for themselves and those around them. The second kind of happiness is, you know, there are two ways, and there is a word in Pali language is para, and so that can be translated in two ways. It can either mean in future, or it can mean it means sort of you know, apart or outside. But it can either mean sometime in the future or else on a higher level. So there are two ways of explaining the second kind of happiness. One is that you are not neglecting your happiness in the next life, because we're not born just one time. It's just not just a one-off thing. Many people trade off. You know, they can be very dishonest and heedless and foolish, and experience quite a lot of success in the world and be rich and wealthy. But then after they die, it's very difficult for them to get a good rebirth. And they often have very painful rebirth in a lower realm as an animal or as a hungry ghost or in a hell realm. And so they are, in other words, trading, you know, like 20, 30 years of pleasure in this life, and giving up the pleasures and happiness in the next life and lives afterwards. So, one way of explaining this second kind of happiness is always bearing in mind, that this isn't the only life, and that we also need to be creating the causes and conditions to be able to experience happiness in future life. But another more immediate way of explaining this second kind of happiness is just the kind of happiness that comes from leading a good life, the happiness that comes from kindness and generosity, helping other people, doing good deeds, leading a moral life, that kind of pleasure and happiness that comes from not harming others, not hurting others, being able to set boundaries for yourself and live within them. And then the happiness of meditation and inner peace and being able to let go of all the negative mental states that cause you suffering. And then the third kind of happiness, that's the ultimate happiness of enlightenment and nibbana, where you have no more suffering because you've abandoned all the causes of suffering. So this is a kind of a blessing, Kohe Suk Sam Yang Lon. It means like, may you experience all three kinds of happiness, you know, to the greatest extent. So the Lon, you know, there's no. So that's just the word Lon at the end is just a poetic phrase to, you know, may you have a lot, may you experience them completely. This question says, what is the most important quality of a human being, and how do we acquire it if we are lacking? Well, I generally speak about the Buddhist teachings as a comprehensive, or we can say holistic, system of education. And so looking at Buddhism in this way, although we can see certain qualities which are singled out as being especially important, at the same time, it's not the case that we can just say, yes, this one quality is the one that we need and the one that we should try to acquire, because every quality is connected to so many other qualities. So if I did have to choose one particular quality, then I suppose my first choice would be wisdom. But in the development of wisdom, then there also has to be a practice of generosity and kindness and mindfulness and patience and perseverance and so many other qualities before wisdom can really function in the optimum way. So there are so many different qualities that need to be developed in harmony. We've got a Thai question here.
เวลานั่งสมาธิแล้วเหมือนหลับแต่ไม่ค่อยแน่ใจแต่ก็สบายดีจะแยกแยะออกได้อย่างไรขอบพระคุณครับ
Okay, so someone says after they've been meditating, then they feel, you know, almost as if they've been asleep, not really sure what kind of state it was, but it kind of feels good. You know, what's going on? Well, I did mention a number of times that the word Buddha or Putta means awake, or the awakened one. And that gives an indication that the essential quality that we're seeking to develop in meditation is that sense of wakefulness, of being awake. Now, it's very difficult because usually we have so much going on in our mind, so much thinking, that the only time that we really experience a slowing down of thinking is when we're going to sleep. So it becomes conditioned in our mind that less thought means time for bed, time for sleep. And that's such a very deep habit. It takes a long time to go beyond that. So it's very common, almost everyone who meditates finds this, that when they start off, the mind's just like crazy, like say like monkey mind. It's rushing here and rushing there, and you go, wow, you know, this is impossible. But then if you stay with it for a while and keep doing it and keep bringing your mind back, it starts to get a bit better. But then just as you think, oh, now I'm getting somewhere, I'm making some progress, and then it's like a pendulum and it swings over to the other side and you get all drowsy and sleepy. And then you get even more depressed, you know, because it's like one thing after another. And this switching back and forward between periods of agitation and so much thinking and then just dull, drowsy mind is, you know, one of the great challenges for the new meditator, particularly. And it's, you know, something that almost everyone has to go through. But there are some things that we can do to reduce that problem. One is to remind ourselves that we're not meditating just to have a kind of feeling of sabai like that, because that's setting up a very dangerous goal for yourself. If you think you know what peace or kwam sungop is, and you think it's just not thinking, then you just go into this very blurry kind of hypnotic state. Because samadhi is not just not thinking or not agitated, but there has to be this very clear, sharp, bright awareness in your mind. So that's your indicator of whether or not this has been a samadhi or just a dull state. If you go into that dull state, it's just like having a nap, you know, like a power nap, if you like. You know, afterwards you wake up, it feels quite good. You feel refreshed in the sense that, you know, just like you would if you just nodded off for 5 minutes. But the difference is that if it's been samadhi, you know, you feel different afterwards. And sometimes the effect of it can last for hours even. And your experience of people around you, the things that are happening, is different. And you become very sensitive to beauty and goodness and kindness. And you become sensitive to impermanence and change, and the mind becomes, you know, it's like you've gone into like from, you know, like from a very old TV, you know, gone into like super HD high definition, you know. But if you've just gone into that dull, sleepy, you come out and you're exactly the same as you were before you went in. But samadhi has this purifying effect on the mind. And that's why it's such an important foundation for wisdom, because it gives you the strength and the clarity of mind, which enables you to see things more clearly.
ครับธรรมศาสตร์อาจารย์ที่ฉันเพิ่งเลิกกับคนรักได้ให้อภัยเขาแล้วแต่ชอบมีความคิดไม่ดีโผล่ขึ้นมาเกี่ยวกับเรื่องราวในอดีตควรทำอย่างไรคะ
yeah, this is of course most common after any kind of unpleasant experience, any kind of separation, separation from someone we love, separation from something we love or attached to. But particularly in the case of separation from someone we love, then there are so many thoughts popping up in your mind all the time. If it's and it can be anything, you know, just anything can just be like a sign that just remembers, oh yes, that reminds me of when we did this together, or a birthday or a special day, or so many things can just be triggers for memory. So there are usually two ways people have of dealing with this. Is to just follow it, unless the mind just goes along and just drawn into this daydream and making yourself even more sad than you were before, and just becoming really depressed or tearful. But the other, so that doesn't work very well, and just goes on and on. The other extreme is when you just try to force your mind, I'm not going to think about him or her at all, just stop, just go away, you know, and just try to force that thing out of your mind, or perhaps distract yourself with something. So the middle way of the Buddha is simply to recognize a thought or a memory as a thought, as a memory. That's all you have to do. So it comes up into your mind, you don't grasp onto it, and you don't push it away. You just see it, oh, there's a sad thought, or there's another memory. And it's something that is happening in the present moment. It's a mental state which has a beginning and has an end. And if you don't react to it emotionally, either with grasping onto it or rejecting it or fighting against it or feeling oppressed by it, you're just simply very calm and just, oh, here it comes again. It's like an echo of something that's gone. And each time that thought or that memory arises and you receive it in that calm way, without adding on to it, without fighting it, it becomes a little bit weaker. And it gradually fades away because you don't feed it. So there are two ways of feeding these like poisonous thoughts or unhappy thoughts. One way is just to follow it and just boom, bang, you know, and just go on and on and on, daydreaming. And the other way is to fight with it or reject it. So the purification and the freedom from it is just seeing that all it is just like an echo. It's just like a footprint. It's just like something that's stuck in your memory. And if you feed it, it'll stay a long time. If you don't feed it, it'll gradually fade away. But you have to be patient, because these kinds of thoughts are not going to go away overnight. If it's someone you've loved for a long time, or it's a very strong feeling, then it's going to take some time. It's like you have a wound that you have, you know, before it'll heal and scar, then takes some time. What you do is you keep if you have a wound, you keep it clean. You can't just say, go away, I don't want to have that cut on my arm or on my heart anymore. But it's, you have to allow it to heal in a natural way. Okay. My question is about being dependent on daily chanting and meditation to maintain basic happiness. For example, recently, when I was traveling and not able to follow regular practice in the mornings, the defilements pretty quickly took over. Yes, it is, really important to find ways of maintaining that basic practice, even when it's not so easy to do so. Even when you're traveling and it's not so convenient, sometimes certain sacrifices have to be made, like sleeping a little bit less and getting up a little bit early in the morning, or consciously taking this need for period of quiet and reflection as an important part of a daily schedule. But usually, even if there's a lot going on, you can always find a little time early in the morning, perhaps before everyone else has got up, or late at night. But there are also many other kinds of practice that we can do during the day. For instance, walking around, just a few minutes here and a few minutes there of walking mindfully, or sitting, sometime just doing a 60-second, 1 minute or 2 minute meditation, just to recharge your batteries and reestablish your mindfulness. So it doesn't mean that you have to, find half an hour or an hour during the day, if that's sometimes that may not be possible. But even when there's a lot going on, just to sit quietly and watch your breath for a minute or 2 minutes, and it's very refreshing, and you think, yeah, I'm ready to go again, start again. And it helps you to prevent this gradual accumulation of stress during the day. Because usually there's in most days, there's not really big stressful things going on, but there tend to be a lot of small stressful things. And they accumulate over the day, and they add up and they add up. So by the end of the day, you feel really stressed out. So to prevent that happening, if you can just be stopping every hour or two and just a minute or 2 minutes, just to come back and relax your body and just breathe in, breathe out, be mindful. That is practical, I think, and it means that when you do have time to meditate, it's like you have a sense of continuity, and that even though you've had a busy day, you can still come back to the meditation quite easily. Okay, we have another. This regards the first question about Meru Yong Meipit. Without intention, does it make the person less guilty for the crime committed? Is the action or karma less meaningful? Well, you see, when we talk about intention or jetana in Buddhist teaching, Buddhist psychology, then what we mean is, let's say the case that, let me see, what would be an example? Let's say somebody believes that this person is like an evil terrorist, and if he gets out of Banbun, he's going to go to Bangkok and he's going to detonate a dirty bomb and kill thousands and thousands of people. Okay. And so somebody says, I got to stop him. Okay. And he thinks it's so important. He kills him. And he kills him and he thinks he's a hero. because he's saved thousands of lives. So you can say his intention, now a normal way of saying was his intention was to kill this evil person, and he did it for a very noble reason. But in Buddhist psychology, that's not the intention. The intention is to kill another human being. That's the karmically important intention. Is there the intention to kill? Is there the effort to kill? Does the person die? Those are the three things. Or even if you don't kill directly, if you get someone else to kill for you. Yeah. So your reason for killing is something which will determine how heavy the karma is, but not whether the bad karma has been created. Because the intention to kill, acting upon that intention, leading to the death of another person, that's already very heavy karma, whatever the reason for it might be. So there's always intention, except, of course, in the case of an accident. If you're driving your car and then somebody rushes out in front of the car and you don't have time to brake and they die, then you have not created any karma, assuming that you were driving within the speed limit and you were careful and you weren't drunk or anything, then there's no karma because there was no intention to hurt that person. And there need be no guilt felt about it either. Just sadness that such a thing should happen. I work in sales. My co-workers like to buy red Fanta and place it next to a statue, then recite a passage. They say it helps with closing deals. They do it every day. My question is, does that work? Is there a spirit out there that can help us salespeople to close deals, or is it just superstitious? Is there a spirit out there? Wouldn't the spirit want something else besides red Fanta? Yeah, this is always the question, isn't it? You close this many deals with red Fanta. You know, what would you? How many would you close with Sprite or Diet Coke, you know? The way that superstition works is that it's always open-ended, that you can never prove. You know, you say, well, put the red Fanta there and you recite the passage, then you close deals, then, you didn't close every deal, did you? Maybe you closed 70% of deals, but why didn't you close 100%? And then someone who really believes would say, well, if we didn't put the red Fanta there, we wouldn't have got 70%. You see, so there's always a way out, you know, in a logical way when someone's superstitious, you know, and this is when people say, oh, I prayed to God and I got this and before my life was terrible and then when I did this and then, you know, every religious tradition, you know, there are people with these beliefs. But, you know, it is possible to run a scientific experiment, you know, but people usually not willing to do this. But, you know, if you say to your co-workers, okay, let's give this a try. Let's do a month of Red Fanta, a month of Aura, bottle of water, and a month of nothing. And let's see the effect on sales. Is it a significant difference? If there's a significant difference, then whether or not we believe it, or, you know, why the reason, well, okay, go for it. But I think that, you know, that it is worth trying to come up with some way of deciding whether or not these things are significant, because superstitions grow up so easily because people don't really investigate causes, conditions. Like, for instance, if you have a strong belief in something, then that is, you know, there are people say, you just got to believe, you know, you can do anything if you just believe in yourself. I believe in you, you know, you've got to believe in you, and then you can do it, you know, which to me is rubbish, you know, it's just, I mean, it's pathetic. I mean, it's just, surely it's obvious. So I remember one year in Ubon, the director, Puam Noi Gan of the hospital, he got really inspired with this book called The Secret. You see that book? Silly book. And and so he gave a copy to all the doctors for New Year's present. So he was telling me, you just got to believe. I said, okay, so let's say all of the doctors, they decide they want to be the Puam Noi Gan. Does that mean all of the doctors in Ubon Hospital can be the Puam Noi Gan? Well, obviously. I mean, it's just so obviously ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, if you all the things that people want are always less than the number of people who want them, you know? And so how can everyone always be number one? Just because they want something. But once you have that idea, then you can always twist it where you say, well, I really wanted this and I never got it. You know, I really believed in myself. But yeah, but you didn't believe in yourself enough. Yeah. You've got to believe in yourself more than that, you see. So there's always a way of twisting these things, and superstitions survive. Like in Ubon, you know, in Isan, where monks give talks, you know, often they listen for the lottery number. Okay. So, and if you give talks on regular basis, you know, it's pretty sure you get a reputation for giving the good lottery number. Why? Because if you have like 200 people getting a lottery number from your talk, you know, the statistic, you know, it's just logical that at least one person every week will win. And they'll say they won because they listened to a talk from Ajahn Jayasaro, you see. There's another really, does anybody know this guy in England called Derren Brown? Do you know who Derren Brown is? Some of you in England. Well, he's really, really good. Anyway, he did this thing where, I'm not sure of the numbers, but I'll give you this. Let's start off with a really big number. Let's say 1 million people, okay? And you send an anonymous email to everyone of these people. And you say, tomorrow there's a horse race, 2 o'clock, Newmarket. And I want to tell you that this horse is going to win. And so let's say you have 1 million people and there are 5 horses in the race. So you 200,000 people, you say horse number one wins. 200,000 people, you say horse number two wins. 200,000. So at the end of the race, sure thing, 200,000 people are going to think, wow, that's incredible. He forecast the horse. How did he do that? Ajahn Jayasaro, wow, really special. So let's see, it's me doing it. I wouldn't, but I'll tell you. So now, a week later,
I send another email to these 200,000 people and I say, okay, you know, I really want to help you. I've got so much metta for you. I want you to do well. Tomorrow there's another horse race, 2 o'clock in Newmarket. And so these 200,000 people, I divide them into 5 groups again. And group one, I say horse number one's going to win. Group two, horse two. Group three, horse three. And so 40,000 people are now really inspired because I've forecast the right horse in 2 races in a run. So now next week, I say 40,000 people. I say, I'm going to tell you the right horse again. Go for it. And I divide them into 5 and I give them a horse. So 1/5 of those. So you keep going like this until you've got like a small group of people. And wow, look, this isn't superstition. Look, you just tell me how this is possible. 6 weeks in a row, you know, he's told me the right horse. How is that possible? You know, so this is the way these kind of beliefs grow up. There's also a story in a Japanese Zen monastery where the abbot of the monastery had a cat. And when he would go into the meditation hall to lead the meditation, chanting meditation, the cat in his room was like scratching at the door and annoy everyone. So the monks got together and they said, look, we've got to do something about this. We're going to have the cat come into the meditation. So where are we going to put the, well, it's the abbot's cat, it's a special cat. So they made a very special cushion for the cat. And so after a while, they studied somebody, a monk, would walk in behind the abbot with this cushion and the cat sitting on the cushion. And they put the cushion down. And because it's Zen, they do it in this very beautiful, elegant way. And it becomes more and more of a ceremonial thing. You know, you have a competition. Who's going to be the monk that carries the cat? You know, and it's special favor. And, of course, time goes on. And the reason for the cat coming in with the abbot is forgotten because all the monks were there. They've gone their different ways. And the abbot dies. And so they keep carrying the cat in. And it becomes this thing. In our monastery, this is what we do. You know, when the abbot sits down, then the cat's, you know. And then, you know, the cat dies and they get another cat. And after like 100 years, you know, this becomes, you know, like a really kind of holy ritual. You know, this is, and if we didn't do this, terrible things would happen. So this is the other thing that superstition plays upon, fear. You see, this is, yeah, maybe, you know, I don't really believe about this Red Fanta bit, you know, but, you know, better safe than sorry, you know, because who knows what, Fanta doesn't cost very much, you know, it's not a big deal. And, you know, I don't want to loplu, you know, and then lose my job because they're not making any sales. And so there's desire, there's fear, there's, you know, all, so superstition is really important to understand. And, you know, and there's a lot of superstition in religions. It's something we always have to be very wary of. But as, you know, there is this very beautiful Thai idiom we have is mai chua ko mai lop lu. And that's like classic Thai culture, something very to be very proud of, because there are very few cultures that are mature enough to have that idea out there in the culture. In most cultures, you know, if you don't believe what the majority believe, then you're like wicked and bad and you have to be sorted out. So Thailand's always been a very tolerant society. It's something that we need to really treasure and uphold. But at the same time, when there are, it is possible to put something to the test. You like say, okay, if you're really really so convinced, you know, let's try it. Do it just for a period and see whether there's any real effect on sales. But let's say,
if you, going back to the point about the secret, it's not that you're successful because you believe, but when you believe, you just tend to have a lot more energy and you put a lot more into something. If you think that something is definitely going to happen, then you're that much more intent on it. You put that much more energy in that, is this going to work? Well, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. Can't really be bothered. It's such a hassle. So this praying and ceremonies and superstitions, if we look in terms of psychology, the psychology of it is that it gives you a lot of energy. And it's the energy, if anything, which is the active factor. Okay, I think that's all the questions. Oh. This one. Okay, this is a good one. Is Tang Sai Glang, and that's, we translate that as the middle way. Is the middle way, or Tang Sai Glang, the same for everyone? Is it subjective or objective? There was a famous example or story about Ajahn Chah. And he was sitting underneath his kuti and answering questions. And someone said to him, you seem very inconsistent. You don't give the same answers. You know, one person, you tell them to push and push, and someone else you tell them to relax and so on. And it doesn't seem any clear cut path that you're teaching. And he said, no, that's not the case. He said, it's as if there is a road or a path, and I see someone and they're getting lost. They're going to make a left turn off the path. So I shout out, go right, go right. And then someone else is getting lost and they're going off on the right side, and I say, go left, go left. So for someone who doesn't understand the path, they say, oh, this teacher, you know, don't understand what he's teaching. Sometimes he says right, sometimes he says left. But for the teacher who sees the path, what he's doing is he's making corrections and keeping people on the path which he sees. So the middle path is not the same for everyone, and it's not the same for one person all the time, because you can get periods where you get very lazy and then you have to put some extra effort. And if someone was looking from outside, they might say, oh, you know, he's far too strict. You know, that's not the middle way. That's just over the top. But in that person's, on that person's path, that short period of like special effort is bringing them back to like the balance that they need. Or someone else maybe has been too strict, too tough on themselves, and they need a period of more relaxation. And then that too, for someone who doesn't know the whole story, just looking at a very short period of time, they might say that person's lost it and his person's not trying anymore. But the, you know, the middle path is, I think the best way to have some idea of it, when you're practicing, is through an analogy. Now, if you've played any, sport in, let's say, tennis or something, or golf or whatever, in which you you play someone who's just a bit better than you are. It's like the best game, I think. You know, if you play with someone who's so much better than you, you know, it's just really depressing. And if you play someone and you're much better than they are, it's no fun. But if you play someone who's just a bit better than you, you find yourself improving. You find yourself having to push yourself because it's just a bit further than you've gone. It's just a stretch. So that sense of just stretching yourself a little bit out of your comfort zone, that's a good idea of the middle path. So I would say, is it subjective or objective? Well, there is a path, and your sense of whether you're on it or not is not really reliable, but that there are certain signs that you can observe.
Jit sampan gap samong yang rai. Jit sang samong. Samong ke jit. Samong ben suun nung kong rang gai ti rau. Mede ben jau kong yang te jing. Question mark. Okay. So the, this is a huge question, the relationship between the jitta, the mind or heart, and the brain. I think if any of you are studying science, you would know that there's a very strong materialist bias in brain science generally, and the idea that the mind is a product of the, or an expression of the working of the brain. But the problem with this view, there are many problems with it. One is that no scientist has been able to come up with any mechanism to explain exactly how does consciousness arise from chemicals. So this is for scientific theory, this is a serious objection. It is more or less a belief. The other thing is that every now and again you hear about scientific experiments where they say this part of the brain is lights up or is active when you have this feeling or when you're thinking. And the idea is that you can map all of your experience onto brain function. In fact, it's so far away from that. It's almost dishonest, I would say. One analogy given is, it's as if you were standing out on the road and you were looking at a big, multi-story building, and you could see all these lights going on and off in the multi-story building, like on the fifth floor and the sixth floor and the seventh floor. And then you could say, there's that light's on in the sixth floor all the time, and that's probably the place where they have the board meetings and this. And you know, it's very imprecise. The other thing is that in experiments they've done, not on human beings, but on I can't remember whether it's flies or rats or something, but they found that if you stimulate, say, some part of the brain, then maybe there is some emotion. So you would say, okay, that means that emotion arises because of that brain or that brain chemical. But then on another time,
Another occasion, you stimulate the same area of the brain and something else happens. Or you can stimulate another part of the brain and that same thing happens. You see, it's not cause and effect, because the same brain area can give rise to different results, and different brain areas can give rise to the same results. Okay, so this is, this is a very big topic, but what I'm trying to do here is to say that it's not proven at all, that the mind is merely a function or an expression of brain chemicals. But we know that giving people drugs which affect brain function affect personality or affect what we call the mind. So there is a connection. But there is also the fact that if you affect the mind, you affect the chemicals. So it's not just a one-way street, it's a two-way street. Because there's something they have discovered called brain plasticity. Plasticity means that something can change, it can move. And so you can affect the function, the structure of the brain, the chemicals of the brain, by how you think or how you use your mind. So if you meditate on a regular basis, not only are you training your mind, you're changing your brain. So there are measurable differences in brain structure and brain function in long-term meditators. You can look some of this work up on the net, particularly work done in America with Tibetan monks who've been on meditating, hooked up to MRI machines over, and very long-term meditators been involved in various programs. So it seems, when someone has some kind of mental problem, and they say, it's just chemicals, and so you've got to take a pill. That really seems like common sense, doesn't it? And it does work sometimes, like from bipolar people and taking lithium and so on. It helps. But let's take the case of depression. Now, depression can be seen as a brain chemical problem, but the research has shown very clearly the past few years that the most effective treatment for chronic depression is what's called MBCT. And MBCT is an acronym for mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. So this is like a talking therapy, and one which is based has borrowed Buddhist mindfulness techniques, because the main underlying cause of chronic depression tends to be certain, like, poisonous ideas in your mind, certain ways of looking at your life and the world. And through mindfulness, you can be taught to recognize these wrong thoughts or poisonous thoughts and let them go. Like, you may have grown up since you were a kid thinking that you're bad or hopeless or nobody loves you or you can't do anything. And these ideas are so deeply embedded that they are a cause for chronic depression. Now, if you take a drug, you can affect the brain chemical, which is the expression of that, but only as long as you take the drug, and not always, even if you take the drug. But by looking at the cause of it, you can let go of the cause and the brain chemicals change. So There is a two-way street. Brain, this injury to the brain affects personality and affects the mind. But the mind and the training of the mind and the state of mind affects the brain.
Okay. Yeah, so the brain is just part of the body. One of the things they found recently about the brain is that when someone that death is not a moment, you know, there's not like a moment when you die and you say, oh, stop breathing or brain function stop, now he's dead. But it's a process, and that after someone has been pronounced dead, the brain is still functioning at one level for at least another 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And they've been able to revive people now based upon the latest science. And I'm not very, don't know enough about this to tell you, because someone was just telling me about it the other day. But the essential idea is that the moment of death is not actually completely dead. There's still this kind of process going on, which can carry on for quite some time afterwards. Okay, we're almost, well, we come around to 12 o'clock. We didn't have a meditation. But evidence of reincarnation. So we don't usually use the word reincarnation in Buddhism. That's more like the Hindu idea. We say rebirth. Evidence of reincarnation. Okay, well, first of all, there is certainly huge amount of material in the Buddhist teachings as recorded in the Tipitaka, Patraipitaka. And well, I can say, well, that's not really, that wouldn't really class as evidence for a non-Buddhist. So that's true. But at the same time, for a Buddhist at least, if we reflect or we think about the fact that all of those teachings that the Buddha gave, which we can put to the test right now in our lives, have proved to be true, then that gives us a lot of confidence, quite a reasonable confidence in those teachings that we have not yet been able to prove. So there's a lot of weight there. I mean, to give an example, there are various theories like in physics and quantum physics and mathematics, which there are only a very few people in the world smart enough to understand. Because someone like Einstein or someone, because they're in the so many other areas of their studies, they've been proved to be right, then there's this trust in them. So that kind of trust in someone who's really at the top of their field is not unusual and something we can agree upon, I think. Secondly, there are so many cases, huge number of cases of people who have been able to remember past lives, and not just in Buddhist countries. And there's a lot of very rigorous scientific research on this. And for anyone who's interested in reading about it, the number one authority
is a Professor Stevenson from the University of Virginia. And he just passed away a few years ago now. But he wrote a number of books in which he gathered all the information on children from around the world who could remember their past lives. And usually it's children of age of 3, 4, 5, before they go to school and they just become, you know, part of their society. Then it's very common, quite common. And the question is, if you don't believe that those are true memories, then how do you explain it? It's very difficult to explain in any other way. Then there are people who meditate a lot, and when their mind becomes very calm and clear, then they also have memories, not all and not many, but a small percentage of people can remember past lives through meditation. And then there are people who remember past lives through hypnosis. So those are the three kinds of evidence. People who remember past lives spontaneously, usually as children. People who remember past lives through meditation. And through people who remember past lives through hypnosis. Okay, that's enough for this morning. So I hope you've been able to understand my English. Is everyone more or less fluent, can understand? If there's anything that's not clear and you'd like some clarification on, then please ask me again in the afternoon session and I can repeat or I expand upon these points in Thai. But for this morning, I think we can end at this point, and you can go and have some lunch. So if you like to